Part 2, Chapter 6, Taking Flight. July 1997. The Casa Hogar Alim Orphanage was about a dozen miles from the Texas border town of Laredo and a world away for us kids from church youth group. There were about 100 of us the first time I went. On the bus from the airport in San Antonio, we leafed through magazines, showing each other the Ford Mustang convertible we had to have and the red, white, and blue Tommy Hilfiger ad for the white polo that was different from every polo we already had because this one was Tommy Hilfiger. I had begun to picture myself not just wearing the clothes in the magazines, but being in the magazines. It felt like I was getting closer. I was 16, just a few days from turning 17. On my birthday, July 10th, I was going to fly to New York for meetings with record labels. I had plateaued on the Christian circuit and needed to go mainstream. Buster came to us shortly after Sarah died and told us the label was folding, so it seemed like all the work producing my gospel album would never see the light of day. My nanny, one of my biggest champions, came to my rescue and gave my father $7,500 to do a pressing of the record so we could make CDs and tapes to sell ourselves at concerts. We named the album Jessica and used one of my black and white Mickey Mouse Club audition headshots as the cover, giving it a sepia tint to make it look arty. I dedicated it to Sarah, and just as I had done with those Jump for Jesus videos, I was relentless, selling those CDs every chance I got. Dad treated it like a business card, and he was effective. My vocal coach, Linda Septian, got us hooked up with Tom Hicks as a potential investor in my career. He was a near billionaire who had recently bought the Dallas Stars hockey team. I used to joke that my dad called 1-800-ENTERTAINMENT-LAWYER to find Tim Mandelbaum, but now I know it was from talking with Linda. Tim was in New York, where all the music labels were, and he shopped my CD around to drum up interest, and there was. After the trip to the orphanage, we were flying straight to New York to meet with 8 labels. Tim had lined up the meetings over a couple days, and I would basically be auditioning at each one, with my dad pitching me as my manager. But first, there was a week-long mission trip to the orphanage. When we drove up to the 2-story complex of sun-bleached stone, everyone got quiet. Now, we weren't a bunch of pampered extras from Clueless. We'd seen poverty up close on mission trips before. As a group, we traveled to the Bowery Mission in New York to sing and serve at the soup kitchen. And we'd done vacation Bible school in Belize, where our van broke down during a rainstorm in the middle of the jungle. We were stranded, and I made everyone get out and pray in a circle around the bus. You know, to heal the van, I guess. Maybe it worked because a busload of soldiers, all with rifles on their laps, happened by. No one said a word the whole way back to the city limits. When we finally got back to the hotel, Carol Vanderslice, my Sunday school teacher, told me she thought, "Great, I'm going to get the pastor's daughter killed." But there was something humbling about the trip to the orphanage. Knowing all the kids who surrounded us had no one but each other and Mama Lupita, the woman who ran the organization. There were about 80 kids of all ages milling around and worn hand-me-down t-shirts with slogans and outdated video game characters. The orphanage had no running water or electricity, and since it was not state-owned, it relied solely on donations and the work of church groups like ours cycling through. Mama Lupita, Guadalupe Carmona was her real name, started the orphanage in 1986 when she took in 4 kids whose father couldn't care for them after their mother died. My dad told me that Mama Lupita also visited prisons to pray with people, and the women there often asked her to take in their kids too. It just grew from there. We spent our week doing odd jobs to fix up the place, cooking meals to serve to the kids, and doing lots of babysitting. We all got so attached to the children that we had kept walking into town to buy them stuff because we had it to give. There was a new baby who had been found in a dumpster and brought to the orphanage the morning we arrived. I pretty much decided it was my job to hold her. I distinctly remember worrying that I was going to confuse her by speaking English, so I called over to one of the smarter kids in the youth group. How do you say I love you in Spanish? I asked. Te amo, Jessica, he said with googly eyes and laughed. I smiled back and turned my face to the baby. Te amo, I said, over and over again, meaning it. I wanted her to know she was loved. I wanted it to be a familiar feeling so that when unconditional love came into her life, she would recognize it. A few days into the trip, I was holding her when someone came looking for my dad. There was someone on the line for him, on the one phone in the whole place. When he came back, he told me it was Teresa Lababera-Weitz, a Dallas-based A&R rep for Columbia under Sony. A&R means artist and repertoire. So they're supposed to scout the talent and then match them with the right material. How did she get the album? I asked. The baby was sleeping, so I kept my voice down. No, my dad said, knowing I wouldn't like the answer. She heard the demos. What? I whispered. How? The demos were three secular songs I recorded at a studio in Dallas and hated. I only did them because it seemed smart to record regular music so I could show the labels I was meeting with what I could do besides gospel. I sang the Celine Dion song Seduces Me and Whitney Houston's Run to You and I Have Nothing. I had the nerve to be upset that I didn't sound like Celine or Whitney on the playback. When the sound engineer, Chuck Webster, said they were fine, I said I was a perfectionist and just asked him to just trash the tapes. If I was going to do mainstream music, I didn't want it to sound like OK Karaoke. Well, Chuck played the demos for Teresa, my dad said. What part of never play this for anybody under any circumstances didn't he understand? Dad shrugged, and he said Teresa was anxious to meet me in person to see if I could really sing. She was upset that I wasn't going back to Dallas before New York. She said she has to see you, he said. When we leave here, she's willing to come down to San Antonio to see us before the flight. I looked down at the baby and sighed. Well, I thought, what difference could it make? Might as well, I said. Dad and I arranged to meet Teresa at a hotel in San Antonio. The first thing I noticed was that she was very pregnant. She later told me that she was 8 months pregnant and had brought her maternity records with her, just in case she went into labor. This was that important to her. You drove all the way down here to see me? I asked. Now I know that being that pregnant on the 4-hour drive down the I-35 would mean hitting the bathroom every single rest stop. She smiled. I flew, she said. 45 minutes in the air. I know we don't have a lot of time and I had to get down here, she said. When she spoke, she was incredibly serene, with long black hair that hung loose around her shoulders. She looked more like a cool art teacher than a music rep. She told me she loved my voice on the tape, but wanted to make sure I matched it in real life. I'm me, I said. We match. We made some small talk, which was very small on my end because I was so nervous. Teresa talked with her hands, and I was kind of mesmerized by the languid movement of these long fingers. Her hands seemed to glide and dip with her accent, which was deeper southern than ours, but still Texas. Teresa told me about her history with Sony and Columbia, how she prided herself on being what she called an artist's advocate, nurturing young talent and putting them with the right songwriters and developing them as songwriters themselves. She had signed a Houston girl group, led by a singer she had known since she was 9. She is 16 now, amazingly talented, she said. Her name is Beyoncé Knowles. I nodded. Dad said, we'll have to remember that name. Finally, I couldn't stall any longer. Should I just sing? I asked. She nodded and then seemed surprised when I started singing a cappella. I did 2 songs, I Will Always Love You and Amazing Grace. She stayed perfectly still as I sang, only speaking when I stopped. Okay, I'm going to New York, she said. I will get you a meeting and you do exactly what you just did. We need to sign you. We're already meeting with Epic, my dad said, playing it cool. Epic was also under Sony, where Celine Dion signed when she came to America. We have 8 meetings lined up, actually. I can get you straight to Tommy Mottola, Teresa said. As green as we were, I definitely knew who Tommy Mottola was. He was the head of Sony, But more important to my mind was that he had just separated from my idol, Mariah Carey, and had signed her to Columbia in the first place. "I'm really blown away," Teresa said, looking right at me, as if she were trying to convince me. "How old are you again?" 17, I said, getting used to the idea. "Today." "Well, happy birthday," she said. Dad and I flew to New York that night to start the rounds of auditions. Through the 2 days in New York, I was fortunate to meet with the heads of many record labels, going into boardrooms and corner offices. There were so few women in the offices, and I'd never felt so Southern, standing there with my long pink nails and hair so high to be nearer my God to thee. I would sing a cappella or listen as they nodded through a song off of my tape. Dad talked a lot, getting better and better with each meeting. A preacher hitting a groove. I kept saying the same thing, remembering why God had even put me in those rooms in the first place. "I will only go with you if you believe that I can change the world." Sometimes they would cock their heads at that, like they were weighing a sales angle. But other times I felt a real connection, particularly at Mercury offices. It was such an innocent way of thinking, and I'm sure some of them thought it was a childlike faith, but they couldn't say it wasn't real. When I sang I Will Always Love You at Jive, they were direct with me. "We just signed a girl who's just like you and sang that same song," someone in a suit said. "This girl, Britney Spears." "Oh, I know her," I said, my stomach flipping. "Small world," he said. "Yeah," I said, defeated all over again. Then at RCA, I got the same story, as if the girl had just been in the same boardroom and ink was still drying on the contract. She'd apparently nailed a song on a Disney soundtrack, and they were going to sign her. "Christina Aguilera something," the guy said, looking around the room for someone to give him the right name. "Aguilar?" "Aguilera," I said, holding back a sigh. "She's really talented." My mother had been right about running into those girls in the future. I didn't expect they'd be taking my spot again this soon. When I got to Columbia in the Sony building in Midtown, Teresa told me she lined up the meeting on the strength of her ear alone. "I didn't play them anything," she said, leading us through an incredible lobby that made me feel tiny. "You just have to let them see you sing." We got there at 11:45, and I remember first meeting someone who acted very important, talking about having to leave for a label lunch. "Well, can you just sit down and listen for a minute?" I said, and I started singing. He sat down. "Oh my God, you can't leave," he said. "I have to go to this thing. Let me sit you in the Sony Club, okay? Have lunch. Don't leave." "We're not," my dad said. Teresa smiled. The Sony Club was in the top of the building, with executive meeting rooms, then all marble and mahogany. But the real draw was the view of Manhattan. You could see the whole city below us. He came back quickly, bringing a bunch of people. I'd go into one office after another until finally they led us to a secret elevator down to Tommy Mottola's office on the 32nd floor. "He listened to Mariah sing in the shower, Dad," I said, as the elevator went down. When I get nervous, most people can't tell. On the outside, I seem very calm, but on the inside, there's a tornado. The doubts and fears swirl, and I keep trying to grab them and compartmentalize them. In the elevator, I started to pray. "God, use me," I thought. "I am here for your will. If this moment is right, it will be the right one." I knew that I had prepared as much as I could. This was not the Mickey Mouse Club. Back then, I didn't even know what preparation meant. And there he was, Tommy Mottola, sitting at his desk in jeans and a black button-down, his hair slicked back. Don Einar, the president of Columbia Records, was also in the office. "So what do you want to do in life?" asked Tommy. I knew the answer to this one because I had just written it in my journal the night before. "I want to be an example to girls all over the world," I said, "that you don't have to compromise your values to be successful." I don't think it was the answer he was expecting. Don piped up. "I've never heard that from anybody in here before. I want to hear you sing." I was so scared. I asked God and Sarah to help me. I stood in the center of the room to sing Amazing Grace. When I finished, I waited a beat before I was about to start I Will Always Love You, but Tommy put up his hand. "That's enough," he said, getting up from his desk. It was over. I didn't know what I did wrong. How had I blown it? I stood there trying to fight back tears, and he said in the same flat voice, "Okay, you can have a seat." My shoulders started to sink, but I held them high. I sat down, and he walked over to stand in front of me. "As far as I'm concerned," he said, "because I still have to talk to Donnie, I would sign you today. Your music is fantastic how it is." I had this tremor of relief go through me. I didn't blow it. And before I could even get to my speech about why I wanted to make music, Tommy started in. "I believe that your voice and who you are as a person and what you stand for can change the world." I was like, sold. We received offers from two other labels. There was Mercury, who had Bon Jovi, and Atlantic, who was putting much behind new artists like Tori Amos, but also had incredible history with Aretha Franklin and the Rolling Stones. I went back to Dallas torn. My parents pressured me to decide, and I was afraid to commit and make the wrong choice for my future. I drove myself to a voice lesson with Linda, and on the way over, I started praying, asking God for a sign. Whenever I asked him for guidance, he came through. Just as I did so, a blackbird flew into my windshield. I screamed, and I bet it screamed too, because it flew straight up. At the next stoplight, I lingered because I was so shaken up. "God, what did that mean?" I asked out loud, alone in the car. "There's no bird records." And I looked over to my right, and I saw the sign, Columbia Hospital. How many times over the years of going to voice lessons I had rolled through this intersection and never noticed that there was a hospital there? "Columbia," I said. "Okay, Columbia." As I moved forward, another blackbird, or maybe the same determined one, swooped down at my windshield a second time. "Okay, I hear you, God," I said, loud so he and the bird could hear me. "I get the message. Thanks, God." I didn't want any more birds getting hurt. My whole family flew back to New York to sign the Columbia contract in Tommy Mottola's office at Sony. Right after we all took a picture, Tommy looked me up and down. "Okay, you gotta lose 15 pounds, Tommy told me. "What?" I said, not really understanding. I was 5'3" and weighed 118 pounds, and I was 17. "I think you're going to have to lose 15 pounds, he said. "Maybe 10, because that's the image you want to have. That's what it'll take to be Jessica Simpson." He spoke clinically, the way a plastic surgeon would take a black marker to show you the flaws that could be magically erased. I looked at my parents. They said nothing. Neither did I. I thought I had the job, and now I had to change myself to be Jessica Simpson. It was as if he tied my value as an artist to my weight right there, like a rock, and then threw it out the window of the 32nd floor of the Sony building. Maybe Tommy was being realistic about the times, and he knew what it would take for me to be successful. He believed in me, and he would be a beautiful part of my career, but it was hard to hear what was required to be a star. I immediately went on an extremely strict diet and started taking diet pills, which I would do for the next 20 years. It's important that I say this now, if only for my daughter, whenever she hears this. You are perfect as you are. But at the time, this is what we thought we had to do. I say we because I was about to become the family business, and there was a lot of pressure to be what the label needed me to be. And my dad didn't know when to say no. We were podunk coming to the big time from nowhere. Any industry room we walked into, whoever was in there had more experience. "This is how it's done," was all we needed to hear. We didn't know if things were being done the right way or if we were being mistreated. We were just glad to be in the room. I only went to my senior year in high school for a month. It felt like a waste of time. We had to leave Dallas so I could start working on my album. Tom Hicks, the hockey team owner friend of my vocal coach, gave my dad $275,000 in exchange for a percentage on the start of my career. I think it was points on my first album, but I never asked. I don't know if my father asked much about it either. The money was more than four times what he made in a year with church and his odd jobs, so he could retire from that career and move us out to Los Angeles. Looking back, I realized that investment money was just for me, but it was the start of the my money is your money mentality that seemed very natural to me. When my dad told everyone at the church we were leaving, I felt responsible for the uncertainty I saw at the Heights. A pastor becomes a father, a shepherd to the flock, and when they leave, people can feel lost. Dad's youth ministry was at an all-time high, with a record number of kids coming to events and church on Sunday. My Sunday school teacher, Carol, a very important person in my life by now, hosted a goodbye party for our family. Each of us had four members of the church assigned to write us a goodbye letter. I was such a crying mess that I can only remember that Beth, my dance teacher, read hers to my mom and Carol read hers to me. "I know the responsibility you feel," Carol said, "and we are always here praying for you, Jessica." "I wish I could bring you to LA with me," I told her after. "I'll visit," she promised. Our move to Los Angeles was set for October 2nd, the day before Ashley's 13th birthday. I bought a used red BMW convertible with some of my signing money, and I drove it all the way from Dallas with my parents caravanning in another car. I have always loved driving and loved that trip, singing along to the radio as the country rock stations of Texas gave way to the pop DJs of the West. We moved into a home that was for sale in Hacienda Heights, but no, we didn't buy it. My mom was a talented decorator, so realtors would let us live in homes and stage them until it was sold. It was the first of many places where we lived the first year because my parents were always working some angle to make money. To say that Hacienda Heights, an hour's drive to the Sony Music headquarters in the usual traffic, was not conveniently located would be an understatement. But we dived into LA life, driving around on the hunt for celebrities. The first big sighting was Garth Brooks, which was a huge deal for us. On a day off from the studio, the whole family went to visit the Bodyguard Mansion in Beverly Hills so I could be Whitney for a moment. Then on to Rodeo Drive so we could have our Pretty Woman moment. We didn't have the money to buy anything, but we touched the fabrics like we were seriously giving it a thought. I doubted they would have the same friendly keep-the-tags-on-return policy as back home. One of the first things I did in Hacienda Heights was take Ashley to the nail salon for a girl's day. I was getting my acrylics in that late 90s French manicure when I looked up and saw a headshot of Fergie. This was before the Black Eyed Peas, so I knew her as Stacey Ferguson from her years on Kids Incorporated. "Love you guys," she wrote in red with a big heart. "She came here?" I asked the nail tech, pointing at the photo. "Oh, sure," she said, "many times." I sat up straighter, turning to my little sister. "Ashley," I said, "we've made it." Teresa had her sister come to take care of her new baby girl. And 3 weeks after giving birth, she took me around to meet songwriters and producers. "Everybody says, 'Oh, I've got a girl that can sing,'" she told me. "But I need people to meet you so they see you're the real deal." We didn't have demos we wanted to play for people, so she would just set up meetings and I'd sing. Teresa didn't want me to do anything that wasn't authentic to my experience. She knew I was inexperienced, so when I recorded love songs, we had to put up pictures of boys I was fascinated with, actors and singers, just so I could emote that longing. I worked hard on my album, but Columbia always had some reason to delay. Well, two. Jive was pushing Britney Spears' album to press, which then made RCA really rush Christina Aguilera's album. As the label argued over calling me Jessica Simpson or just Jessica, there was a sense that I would get lost among the invasion of the teen blondes. I could not believe those two girls were getting in front of me again. The process was also slow because Tommy Mottola had taken such personal interest in my album. He was picky about every single song, getting involved in the mixes of each one. He would come to the studio displaying an ear that I completely respected. There was a reason he was who he was. He liked the song I had written called Heart of Innocence, pulling lyrics from my journal to sing about holding on to my virginity until marriage. I am sure he partially liked it because of the marketing angle. I recorded a strong ballad, Did You Ever Love Somebody, that Columbia was able to get on an episode of Dawson's Creek in November. I watched it with my family, and I jumped off the couch when the show turned up the volume of my voice as Pacey leaned in to kiss Andy. Yes, I loved Pacey Witter, too, so you diehard Creek fans understand what a big deal that was for me. Teresa continued to guide me, always acting as my buffer, wanting me to truly be an artist. If I mentioned worrying about sales or my look, she would remind me just to focus on the work. She sent me amazing tracks and paired me with songwriters who would showcase my voice. Her office also made sure I was working to get my GED and assigned a junior Sony staffer in her office, Casey Cobb, to constantly call me and make sure I was doing my homework and turning it in on time. Casey was 2.5 years older than me and soon took a big sister interest in my life. Schoolwork was definitely not a priority for my parents, but Casey took her job seriously, and she was the only reason I got my GED. When we finally met in person, she was my assigned minder at an event in Atlanta. Her gorgeous hair reminded me of Sarah's, and I was immediately at ease. Whoever was paying for the trip only booked one room with one bed, and Casey's response was like, nope. She was a real professional, and I know she thought of me as a kid. But I felt like Sarah had sent Casey to me, so I was just excited to hang out with her. She had gone to Baylor and understood the business far more than I did. I could ask her real questions about what the label expected of me because I was confused from the mixed messages I seemed to be getting. It had started when Britney was first out of the gate, with her Baby One More Time single hitting in October. She premiered the video on MTV on Thanksgiving Day, and my job had gotten a lot harder. I got word there was a halt on my album, and the label decided I didn't have the right songs and needed more Britney-type songs. I had been signed for my voice, but I had to now contort myself into this mold of a dancer. My answer was, whatever you want. I just wanted to have my song on the radio. The weekend after Britney's Thanksgiving premiere, I was supposed to meet with someone who might co-manage with my dad. His name was Paris Dijon, pronounced like the mustard. He was going to be at the Hollywood Christmas Parade, looking after a boy band he managed. The band was going to be on a float, and their album was performing well. It spoke well of Paris, who was this tough bulldog guy who seemed like he could make things happen just on force alone. And just behind him was the most adorable guy I'd ever laid eyes on. It was the smallest movement, two people locking eyes. At 18, my usual move was to be coy and look away, but I didn't. He came over, walking in a more casual version of the onstage boy band saunter I'd come to see him do time and again, but still purposeful. "Hi, I'm Nick," he said. "Hello, my life," I thought.